the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Today is the 20th anniversary of the Tiananmen Incident. That's how the Chinese call it, the Tiananmen Massacre, as it's better known around the world, which took place there in Beijing, in the capital of China. In the year 1989, several of the communist oligarchies broke up, and we had a real transformation on the world scene. The question was whether or not China, the most populous of all of the communist nations, was also going to undergo a process of liberalization and with increased freedom, marking the experience of the people there. There was obviously hope for that in 1989, and that hope brought out a million people in the Tiananmen Square in downtown Beijing in June of 1989. It was a huge gathering, and the big question was how the communist regime in China would respond to that great demonstration. The demonstration was overwhelmingly one of youth, college students primarily, and younger intellectuals who gathered together. There were speeches. Of course, there was a great deal of call for reform, for liberalization, for freedom. And then the shots rang out in Beijing 20 years ago today, on June the 4th of 1989. It is now believed that several thousand persons were killed by an army known as the People's Army. It requires our conversation. It would be absolutely wrong of us today, on the 20th anniversary of the Tiananmen Massacre, not to talk about what it means and to gain a view of where China is today, 20 years later. What has changed and what hasn't changed? A whole lot has changed. Certainly in terms of China joining a market economy, China becoming a major trade partner and net investor in the United States. There's a huge economic relationship now with China that was inconceivable 20 years ago. In terms of freedom within China, not so much. However, there are changes there too, some of them brought about by technology. One of the interesting things that has been noted in recent days is that the Chinese government put a halt on Twitter and on Facebook and Flickr and other sites, restricted the distribution of the Wall Street Journal Asia edition and other American papers in order to protect its people from a discussion of this incident. But I think you can almost be guaranteed that that discussion is going on. We're going to have a good discussion here on the Albert Mohler Program. My guest is going to be David Aikman, former senior correspondent with Time Magazine, first-hand expert on China, and a friend who serves with me on the editorial board of the Salem Radio Network. He's going to be with us, bringing firsthand experience in China. We're going to look forward to that conversation in just a moment. Those of you who have a word to offer or a question to ask about the Tiananmen Massacre and its meaning, or perhaps just about China today, give us a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. The other thing we have to talk about today is the speech given by President Barack Obama in Cairo, Egypt. The president of the United States went there in order to speak to the Muslim world. And as he spoke there, representing the student body of two campuses and many, many different people associated not only with those two universities, but with other folks there in Egypt and beyond, the president spoke of his understanding of how the American people and the American government should engage the world of Islam. Let's listen to a little what the president had to say. Clip number one.
The fifth issue that we must address together is religious freedom. Islam has a proud tradition of tolerance. We see it in the history of Andalusia and Cordoba during the Inquisition. I saw it firsthand as a child in Indonesia, where devout Christians worshiped freely in an overwhelmingly Muslim country. That is the spirit we need today. People in every country should be free to choose and live their faith based upon the persuasion of the mind and the heart and the soul. This tolerance is essential for religion to thrive, but it's being challenged in many different ways.
I posted earlier today by Twitter and on Facebook and to some other media outlets. I communicated what I called the good, the bad, and the ugly about this address. What you heard there is mostly the good. I think the president accomplished some very good things in this address. I think the idea of speaking to the Muslim world is a net gain. I think this is where this president is on his strongest ground. He is an articulator, and he went to Egypt to articulate. Much of what he said, I think, is very good. So let me go back to the good part. The good part is, number one, clear stress on religious liberty. He spoke of that very, very clearly in the point you heard there. It was the fifth issue of his enumerated points. I think another very important issue he raised was what he called an unbroken relationship, an unbreakable relationship between the United States and Israel. Another very strong statement. He did some other things in the address that I thought were clever. And I don't mean clever in a cheap sense. I mean clever in a very strategic sense. I thought when he spoke of the United States and its legacy of working with Islamic nations and its engagement with Islamic nations, it did a good thing. He did a good thing, that is. And his speech accomplished a positive purpose in speaking honestly, for instance, about the legacy of the United States with Iran and the fact that the United States government was involved in the overthrow of an Iranian government, setting up during the Cold War a regime that we felt would secure that part of the world against the kind of Soviet influence that otherwise would happen. So I thought that was honesty. That is honest. That's just a part of history. And I think we need to make clear that we're the people who are not afraid of history. We're the people who do not hide from history. We want to learn from it. I thought those were strong points, among other strong points the president made. That's the good. Now, there is the bad. And I felt real awkwardness when this president speaks of a language about a partnership between America and Islam. And I think the bigger issue there is when the president of the United States speaks of Islam and speaks to Islam rather than speaking to Muslims, there's a crucial difference. I think this president would have been much better served had he spoken to people rather than to a religion. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure that it is wise in any sense for a president to do that. I want you to hear a statement from this address, and I want us to imagine whether it could have been said any other way.
So I have known Islam on three continents before coming to the region where it was first revealed. That experience guides my conviction that partnership between America and Islam must be based on what Islam is, not what it isn't. And I consider it part of my responsibility as President of the United States to fight against negative stereotypes of Islam wherever they appear.
Fascinating statement. The president here used language that I found truly shocking. The language I will read to you, he says, that experience guides my conviction that partnership between America and Islam must be based on what Islam is, not what it isn't. The words partnership between America and Islam is I think, very unfortunate. I think that is regrettable language that this president will come very quickly to regret. I think it is unwieldy language that is really going to be almost impossible to undo here. So let me ask you again to imagine, what if the president had said partnership with Judaism, or partnership with Christianity, or partnership with anything else? I think you see the problem. He should not have spoken about partnership with Islam. He should have spoken about partnership with Muslim nations, or with Arab nations, or with nations with a predominantly Muslim population. But to speak about partnership with Islam, I think that's much too far. And so that moves from good to bad to ugly. The other thing I mentioned that I found really lamentable in his speech was what I would have to say is incredible PR spin that I think ignores something of the obvious. Here is something of the obvious. He says in another clip, and just for sake of time, I'm going to share it with you here. He says, Islam is not part of the problem in combating violent extremism. It is an important part of promoting peace. And quote, that's just not really honest. Islam is, at least, we have to concede, a part of the problem in combating violent extremism, because the logic of Islam is the logic of Sharia rule, that is, of rule under the Quran, and using force, if necessary, to bring a society under that rule. That is central to Islam. That's not Islamic extremism, that's Islam. And you'll be hard-pressed to find any Islamic authority who would deny that. And so when you look at that, you have to say, this just doesn't help for a president of the United States to say that Islam is not a part of the problem. I can't imagine that that's a statement he's going to be able to stand by as he serves as president of the United States. One other thing, when the president spoke of religious liberty, I want to give him very strong marks for clarity and requiring religious liberty as the price of being in a free society. That was very important. Speaking of the United States as having a legacy and an important priority on human rights related to religious liberty. But when he spoke of religious liberty, he mentioned Indonesia. He really doesn't mention what it's like to be a Christian in a Muslim-dominated land where you may be told you have religious liberty, but just try to build a church. Or just try to witness to your next-door neighbor or hold a Bible study in your home. The Muslim word for it is dimitude. It means the freedom to be dominated by Islam. Not exactly what you would get from the Cairo address. We'll be talking about that more, as I'm sure much of the world will be talking about that address in days to come. We'll be right back to talk about China on the Albert Miller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. The spirit of today's conversation is well represented by the opening section of Nicholas Kristof's column in today's edition of the New York Times, entitled Bullets Over Beijing. Nicholas Kristof writes, quote, "It was exactly 20 years ago that I stood on the northwest corner of Tiananmen Square and watched People's China open fire on the people. It was night. The gunfire roared in our ears, and the avenue of eternal peace was streaked with blood. Uniformed army troops massed on the far end of the square, periodically raising their assault rifles and firing volleys directly at the crowd I was in. And we would all rush backward in terror until the firing stopped." End quote. One of the dangers of the contemporary moment is that we will refuse to look squarely at history, whether it's distant from us or very close to us. 20 years is not even a generation. This is very close to us, and yet all around the world today, there's insufficient attention to what took place 20 years ago today there in Tiananmen Square. My guest today is David Aikman. Mr. Aikman is a dear friend. David's a member of the editorial board of Salem Communications. He is also a professor at Patrick Henry College, where he teaches history. He was a senior correspondent for Time magazine, having held a remarkable number of posts with Time from 1971 to 1994. We'll be talking more about his contemporary work. But, David, I want to welcome you today to the Albert Miller Program.
Thank you very much, Al. Nice to have you. Nice of you to have me on.
Well, I'm glad to have you on. I don't know of anyone who's better placed, really, to talk about China. You've written about China. You spent so much time there. And we're a representative of Time magazine, correspondent there. Were you there when this happened 20 years ago today?
Yes, I was. I arrived actually in Beijing on the morning of the day when everything started, which was actually June the 3rd. And the reason it's called June the 4th is because the shooting went well on to into the next day. But when I got there, I realized that it was all going to be over very quickly. And starting in the afternoon, it was obvious that the army was infiltrating its troops into the area of the square, and then they came in with a real bang at about 10 o'clock at night. And I would say I listened. I was out on the streets at about 4 a.m., and I would say there was shooting in probably 8 different parts of the city that you could hear distinctively. I mean, just an incredible racket, and tracer rounds into the sky. I mean, it was just a very, very noisy and horribly bloody occasion.
Now, David, let's track this back just a little bit. How in the world did a million people end up in June of 1989 in Tiananmen Square in Beijing?
Well, of course, there weren't a million people at the time of the crackdown. The people in the square were just a few hundred students by that time, but there had been a million people in the square protesting really throughout the weeks from the middle of April until everything really until martial law was declared on May 23. And what you had was what started as a student demonstration against corruption in the college placement system for recent graduates, that morphed into just a society-wide demand for more accountability, more openness, more democratic opportunity that involved really virtually all the professional classes in Beijing. It was just an astonishing consensus of society behind what the students had started.
Now, that led to the response from the communist regime. Were you surprised when the army actually started moving on the students?
Well, Al, at the risk of sounding like a smart aleck, no. I was one of the very few correspondents who had predicted from the very earliest moments of the protests that it would be cracked down upon. In fact, I was on CNN with a couple of other former Beijing correspondents from both an American and a European news organization, and I was the only one who said flatly, this is going to end in horrible violence. So the reason I said that was because I had studied Chinese communist history, and I knew that Deng Xiaoping, despite being able to wear a cowboy hat and to certainly make the society much more open than it had been under Mao, was certainly not going to allow a bunch of students to take away Communist Party rule.
Well, and indeed they did not, but the response was just as you had predicted there. It was incredibly murderous. Do we really have any idea what the death toll was from the Tiananmen massacre?
You know, I, with a bunch of other Time magazine correspondents and editors, worked very hard on a book in the weeks immediately following the Tiananmen crackdown, and we came to a consensus that probably it was a minimum of about 700, and maybe it may have been as high as 2,000 or 3,000. Nobody really knows, and I don't suppose anybody in the end will know, because, you know, people just disappeared.
And you're talking about a communist regime that is experienced with making people disappear.
Absolutely. I mean, there were students who were in the square, and even today, there's an organization in China, a civic organization called the Tiananmen Mothers, and there are some mothers who just don't know what happened to their kids. One moment they were students, the next they had just vanished.
You know, David, I have to ask you just a point-blank question, and in one sense I should hold this, but I can't hold it. I just want to ask you, are you shocked that there's so little attention given to the 20th anniversary of this incident?
Yes, I am. I think it's an amnesia which has been rather carefully cultivated by the Chinese government, which has basically airbrushed this event out of Chinese history. I mean, they have done it astonishingly successfully. Al, you have Chinese graduate students, and there are thousands of them in this country. They come over to top-class American universities. They got PhDs in engineering or whatever it is, and they're shown videos of the crackdown in Tiananmen Square, and they say, what? When did this happen? Can this be true? Is it not? Are you not just inventing footage for us? I mean, they just don't know.
That is absolutely incredible. Those of us who live not only in the United States with an incredibly free press, which puts out all kinds of material, but in a digital age, it's just hard to believe that that this kind of thing could be hidden.
Well, it is, except that the Chinese government has probably the most efficient internet blocking system that anybody's ever invented. I mean, it's been reported that there are maybe as many as 100,000 employees of the government whose sole job is to chase down internet sites that they want to block.
Just imagine that. This is a fascinating conversation. It's just going to get more fascinating. I'm going to ask my guest, David Aikman, when we come back to talk about the contemporary scene in China and what it means with Tiananmen in retrospect. David Aikman, you can find out more about by going to his website at davidaikman, that's AIKMAN.com. We'll put the link up at the website for the program for today. When we come right back, we're going to be talking not only about what it meant for these events to happen in China, but what it means for all of us today. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Today is the 20th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing, China. That requires our attention. As Christians, one of our responsibilities is to understand the signs of the times. And it requires an understanding of history and what's going on. We're living in a time of incredible foment and change. China is very much a part of the global scene now, but we can't possibly understand China today without understanding what took place 20 years ago. My guest today to help us figure all this out is David Aikman, who is a member of the editorial board of the Salem Radio Network, of which we are a part, professor of history at Patrick Henry College, former senior correspondent and one who held many other roles at Time Magazine. He was there in the square on June the 4th of 1989. David, again, I want to go back to that conversation, and I want to ask you about something. The contemporary analysis of China suggests that the Chinese government more or less made a deal with its people after the Tiananmen incident, which was, we will move into a market economy and we will make you more wealthy,
right,
but you concede all political issues to the Communist Party. Is that an accurate description?
I think more or less, yes. China went through an extraordinary economic growth spurt, really from about 1990 through 1995, 1996. Its annual GDP growth rate was about 14% at one point. And the ordinary people were so happy to see their living standards rise before their eyes that they sort of agreed to this tacit understanding that they wouldn't raise political issues, the government wouldn't ram political campaigns down their throat, but nevertheless, you wouldn't be allowed to ask too many questions, but just stick your head down and make money.
And China has made a lot of money.
Indeed.
And indeed, many of those students you talked about coming to the United States are being driven by an economic renaissance there.
They are indeed. I mean, one of the curious things about China for much of its communist rule is everybody said, how is it that Chinese are able to make money so successfully everywhere else in the world except China? That was under the Maoist regime. Well, the Chinese have demonstrated they can make money very successfully in their own country if they're given the right conditions.
I want to ask you one more question looking backwards here. In the United States, just over the last 3 weeks, there's been a book released by a now-deceased former premier of China.
Right.
And I know you're going to be able, more than just about anyone else, to tell us what's really going on here. What is all this about?
Okay, Zhao Ziyang was originally premier of China in the early, in the 1980s. And then in the second half of the 1980s, he became head of the Communist Party. But he was the only senior communist leader who said at the Politburo meeting in May 1989, don't send the army into the square against the students. And he resigned from the Communist Party. He then made a very emotional visit to the square with one aide and with a megaphone, in which he sort of sobbingly apologized to the students for having been too late, he kept saying. He was then, he'd resigned from the Politburo, so he was put under house arrest for the next, 15 years of his life, 16 years, and he died in 2005. But while he was in house arrest, secretly, he taped his opinions on a number of very important issues, including the crackdown, and his memoirs have just recently been published.
What do you make of them?
Well, I haven't had a chance to see them myself. I've only read about them. I haven't actually had the book in my hand. But from everything I've heard, Zhao Ziyang is completely consistent in his memoirs with what he was saying when he was in the active leadership, that he wanted to see a gradual change, not just in the economic sphere. I mean, he was basically the guy who orchestrated Deng Xiaoping's push to bring capitalism to China. But he also wanted to make China democratic. Not overnight. He was a gradualist, but he saw that the logic of economic freedom was political freedom, and that's what he was aiming at.
The interesting question now is where China will go from here, not only in terms of economic freedom, political freedom, and in terms of religious liberty. And David Aikman's written a great deal on that, and that's where our conversation will turn when we come right back. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program on the 20th anniversary of the Tiananmen Massacre in Beijing, China.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
The lessons of history are just too important to miss. As a matter of fact, historical knowledge is a matter of stewardship. We bear a stewardship of what we know, what we require ourselves to know, and how we pass on that knowledge. History always requires interpretation. But when you're looking right now at the Tiananmen Massacre 20 years ago today, the amazing thing is the success of the Chinese government in hiding it from their own people. Now, I have in my library a couple of volumes of the old Soviet encyclopedias, and you can always tell who dropped out of favor because they would drop out of the photographs. The old Soviet encyclopedia didn't do a too good a job of actually taking them out. They would often leave the hands in a handshake, and there was just no body with them. Just a symbol that somebody was out of favor. But the Chinese government has raised this particular art to a whole new level. My guest today, David Aikman, former senior correspondent with Time Magazine, a man who was there in the square 20 years ago today, is an expert on China. And you were telling us, David, as we were talking earlier, that the Chinese government has something like 100,000 people just blocking Internet sites?
That is the figure I've heard. If it's not 100,000, it's a huge, huge amount of people because they essentially block absolutely everything. I mean, they've got filters that trip up on words like Tiananmen or massacre or anything like that. It's virtually impossible, unless you know your way around the Internet, unless you've got friends who can forward stuff to you in a sort of private email, assuming your email is not being monitored. It's almost impossible to find out as an Internet researcher what happened.
That's just incredible, but it shows you that that's the determination of this state to hide from this event. And a state that hides from its history usually has a history from which it should certainly want to hide. But
that's
it will not stay hidden long.
Now, no, David, it won't. I mean, I've read a marvelous book written by a former Washington Post correspondent in China, Philip Pan, called Out from Mao's Shadow, which tells the story about a handful of Chinese who have, with painstaking dedication, at great personal cost, accumulated the historical details of not just the Tiananmen massacre, but the Cultural Revolution, the anti-rightist campaign of 1957-58, the Great Leap Forward, and all of the other disasters that Mao visited upon his own people.
Let me ask you a straightforward question here, as time is brief, and this is just really important. And I'm speaking here to David Aikman, a man I know, and I know I can trust to ask this question. Why should Christians today, on June the 4th, 2009, take a particular interest, American Christians, in what went on in China 20 years ago today?
Well, very briefly, Al, one of the reasons is that one of the good results of the tragedy of Tiananmen was that many students who literally worshipped democracy, I mean, they had a statue of the goddess of democracy in the square, they realized after the crackdown that China needed a moral change before a political change, and many of them have actually turned to Christianity.
Now, in your book, Jesus in Beijing, How Christianity
Right.
is Transforming China and Changing the Global Balance of Power, you really make that point. Can you track that through for us? Bring it to 2009.
Well, basically, there has been a growing Christianization of all segments of Chinese society. And in the last 4 or 5 years, the professional classes and the intellectuals, to a remarkable degree, have been converting to Christianity. And you've got churches now which are not really underground churches, they're just independent house churches in all of the major cities of China. You've got Bible studies on every university campus in China. I mean, it's just remarkable.
Now, let me ask you to track that through with one other issue. I had a guest from China,
right,
who was in a safe place to talk to me about these issues.
Right.
And there's a man and his wife, and she was a former member of the Communist Party.
Right.
And they told me that there are now Communist Party members who are rather open about the fact that they are Christians.
Well, it's true, but it's not true universally. I have met very senior Communist Party members who have been baptized in water and have actually told their superiors that that's what the situation was, and they're still in the party. But the trouble is, Al, you can't predict what winds of change will sweep through the Chinese government. You may think you're okay,
yes,
because the mood is quite placid now, but in 2 weeks' time, you know, there's a squabble at the highest level of the party, and then you're in trouble.
Well, and the very fact that this couple was in the United States and she is a former member of the party, I think, makes that point.
That's right, yeah.
Let me ask you another question just about Christianity in China. The World Christian Encyclopedia is undergoing a new revision. I understand that the data coming in is indicating that China is now the nation of the largest population of Christians in the world. What does that tell you when, in the Maoist Revolution, that communist regime did everything within its power to eradicate Christianity?
Well, of course, you're as familiar as I am with Tertullian, the blood of the martyrs of the seed of the church, that Christianity, when it's under pressure, really comes into its own. People who are forced to choose Christian faith against state-imposed options, when they become Christians, become vibrant witnesses for the gospel of Jesus Christ.
You know, you probably know thousands of anecdotes like this, David, but I was with a Chinese man who told me that his father had been punished during the Communist Revolution in the late 1940s and into the 50s. He had been a well-known pastor, and to humiliate him, in a small village in rural China, they made him go house to house to remove the chamber pots and to remove the trash. And it was to humiliate him, but as the son said, it turned my father into a door-to-door evangelist.
So absolutely.
Regimes do what they think will eradicate the faith, only to end up spreading it.
Well, that's right. And these struggle meetings where they tried to humiliate pastors in front of other prisoners in the jail, and the pastors have ended up preaching a powerful sermon.
That goes all the way back to the Apostle Paul and the Praetorian Guard. You know, that does warm my heart in the midst of a conversation about a very tragic anniversary. My guest today has been David Aikman, former senior correspondent with Time Magazine, the professor now of history at Patrick Henry College, author of a book you need to know, The Delusion of Disbelief, Why the New Atheism is a Threat to Your Life. You'll find that and other materials at his website at David Aikman, that's AIKMAN.com. David, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me on, Al.
An invaluable conversation. We'll be back with final thoughts in just a moment on the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We are living in a world that is growing more complex by the moment. And today, just on the Albert Mohler Program, we often talk about so many things that are basically domestic. We talk about issues of how Christians should think about family and marriage. And we think about education and Christian worldview applied to so many of the issues that certainly roil our own controversies here. As we try to think about what would be required of us to be Christians, to think and act as Christians, given this circumstance or this particular issue. But today we've had to look really far beyond the United States of America. We began today by looking to Cairo, Egypt, where the President of the United States gave an address to the Muslim world. And then we looked back 20 years ago to the Tiananmen massacre, which took place 20 years ago today there in Beijing, China. There are two things I think we really need to keep in mind here. The first is the reality of a global world. And we're living in a world in which what takes place in China does affect what takes place here. And if you don't believe that politically, you certainly know it economically. Because in the last several days, China has emerged as the owner of what was now a former line of General Motors. And it will be now headquartered in China. We're living in a world in which China now owns a great deal of the debt of the United States of America, which is one reason, Christians, we should note, a very muted response on the 20th anniversary of the Tiananmen massacre from the United States government. Very different than probably would have taken place in times past. Not only are we looking at a very mixed global situation, which presents challenges to those of us who look at the globe, not first of all in terms of American interest, but in the interest of the Great Commission. We also recognize that there's a burden of history here. 20 years ago today, the lives of several hundred, if not a few thousand young people, those lives are snuffed out by a communist autocracy that was determined to clamp down on its citizens. The People's Army declared war on the people. And the avenue of eternal peace, as Nicholas Kristof wrote this morning, became filled with blood. You know, we do need to look back at that and say, even from a secular perspective, that was one of those events that should not escape our attentiveness. We should think about that 20 years later. But from a Christian perspective, there's even more here, because as I've said, for us, history is a stewardship. There are some of us tonight who need to have conversations with our children at the dinner table to say, you need to know what took place in China 20 years ago today. You need to be thankful that you don't face the same kind of dangers and instead enjoy very different liberties here in the United States of America. Tell them why we believe those liberties are important and tell them how thankful we should be to be in a country where those liberties are experienced. Remind them that they were bought with a price and maintained with constant vigilance. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. We're going to have an opportunity to talk with author Scott Klusendorf about his book on how to make the arguments about abortion. Fascinating conversation. We'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.